It is Wednesday, November 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, a tribunal convicts former Bosnian Serb commander Ratko Mladic of genocide and war crimes. As Zimbabwe prepares for a new president, we look back at the leadership of Robert Mugabe. And pop singer David Cassidy dies at the age of 67. It's all ahead. The United Nations Yugoslav War Crimes Tribunal ruled Wednesday former Bosnian Serb army leader Ratko Mladic is guilty of genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity stemming from the conflict in the former Yugoslavia during the 1990s. The court convicted Mladic on 10 of the 11 charges he faced, including persecution, extermination, murder, deportation, terror, and unlawful attacks on civilians. He was sentenced to life in prison. Rachel Kerr is a reader in international relations and contemporary war at King's College London. She spoke to me about the significance of the verdict.
I think it's significant in a number of respects. It's significant for the tribunal because it's their final trial judgment. So this is the sort of last act of the ICTY having been established 24 years ago, to prosecute people responsible for war crimes in former Yugoslavia. So it's significant for the ICTY as a final judgment, and it rounds off the cases that concerned the whole of the former Yugoslavia, but mostly the ones that concerned the Bosnian Serb leadership, and especially regarding Srebrenica. But I think it's also really important for the region and for the victims of these crimes. I think there's been many victims have welcomed this judgment today. There's some consternation about the genocide charge relating to the municipalities, but overall, I think the fact that he was convicted on the majority of the counts and given life imprisonment is significant and possibly allows some time now, some space now for people to kind of move on and sort of get on with things now that the tribunal main activities are completed with this trial.
Why was Mladic, is it known why Mladic and others in the Bosnian Serb leadership were intent on basically destroying Bosnian Muslims?
Well, it was part of the strategy of ethnic cleansing. So the conflict started in 1991 in Croatia, and then, in Slovenia, and then moved to Croatia, and then moved to Bosnia. And in Bosnia, it was really a conflict over the future of the Bosnian state, and there were different visions of what that should be. And the Bosnian Serb leadership essentially wanted to cleanse parts of Bosnia in order to be able to then attach those parts to a greater Serbia. So it was a case of trying to get rid of all of the non-Serbs. So it wasn't only Bosnian Muslims, but also Bosnian Croats who were living in areas that were earmarked to be carved off, who were subject to ethnic cleansing.
Now, Mladic blamed other people within the Bosnian Serb leadership for the many deaths, but it seems like evidence shows that he was very much responsible as well.
Yeah, that's right. I think Mladic's defense kind of ran on two lines. So he tried to shift the blame upwards or up to the political level and say that it was directed by Karadzic, for example, or even by the Serbian government, and that he was merely carrying out his responsibilities as commander of the armed forces and not making political decisions. But he also tried to shift the blame downwards as well and said that if crimes did take place, they took place not under his command, so he couldn't be held directly responsible for them, and that they were sort of aberrations, if you like. So it was those sort of two lines of defense, and I think the trial chamber in their judgment roundly sort of denied both of those defenses because the evidence was overwhelming to show that Mladic was responsible in his capacity as commander of the Bosnian Serb armed forces for what happened under his command, under direct orders relating to that.
And at the towards the end of the war in 1995, there were the killings of more than 8,000 Muslim men and boys in Srebrenica, which became the worst massacre in Europe since World War II.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And so the judgment, the finding that the guilty verdict on Mladic for Srebrenica, so his participation in the joint criminal enterprise that led to the death of those over 8,000 men and boys in Srebrenica, is enormously significant, I think, for the victims and victims' families for Srebrenica, and because it is such a it was such a horrific single act of genocide and of ethnic cleansing. So the pattern is seen in other places in Bosnia, but it's not to the extent that it was seen in Srebrenica in July 1995, which also led to more concerted action to actually bring the conflict to an end. I think it was a turning point from that point of view as well, but it has been really important to establish individual criminal responsibility for that act, because as you say, it was the worst massacre on European soil since the Holocaust.
Rachel Kerr of King's College London. Well, joining me by phone is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's trending?
Well, the big story today, Sarah, hashtag net neutrality. The idea of net neutrality is that internet service providers can't charge more money for certain websites or services. And that's actually a policy that was instituted under the Obama administration. But with the Trump administration and the new Federal Communications Commission chairman, Ajit Pai, they have signaled that they would like to repeal that. So it is a big win for internet service providers. They can charge, for instance, more money for people who want to watch faster videos or people who want to access, say, a movie website like Netflix. For a lot of content creators and internet users, this has become a big point of contention. They say it's going to hurt consumers. It's going to cost them more money to get online and use the services that previously have been equal. So we're seeing a lot of talk about that on social media as they plan next month to vote to repeal those regulations. A lot of lobbying on behalf of companies like Netflix, YouTube, other services that allow people to create online content. They'd like to see net neutrality stay in place so that they are not penalized for doing these different services. But that is a big point of talking on conversation on social media today. Of course, the other big story here in the United States is Thanksgiving, which is tomorrow, which means today is the traveling for Thanksgiving. It's actually the busiest travel day of the year in the United States, and we're seeing a lot of talk on social media about just that, about the traveling, whether it's the traffic on the roads, the lines at the airport, people trying to get from point A to point B with few delays as possible. And social media has actually become a big asset for a lot of folks checking traffic reports and reports about delays, weather delays, making sure their flights and trains and all other modes of transportation get out on time. But I think later this afternoon, we're going to begin to see that shift. And as people get home, we're going to see a lot more posts about people reuniting with family and friends as they prepare to celebrate tomorrow. And, of course, all of the posts about the foods that people are looking forward to. We'll have more about Thanksgiving on the holiday tomorrow. But for right now, the preparation continues, and that's reflected on social media.
And I guess also eventually about the diets you have to go on once the holiday's over.
That's Friday. You know, today's the travel, Thursday's the food, Friday's the diet, and the shopping, because that is Black Friday, the holiday for shopping after Thanksgiving.
Absolutely. Thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. The Kremlin vows to defend a Russian oligarch who's under arrest in France. A U.S. regulator proposes replacing the Internet Equality Plan. 8 people are rescued and 3 are missing after a U.S. Navy plane crashes in the Western Pacific. And a Pakistan court orders the release of a cleric wanted by the United States for terrorism. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
In September 2015, NASA said they had confirmed evidence of liquid water flowing on present-day Mars. the space agency said their Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter identified the chemical signature of hydrated salts and minerals in mysterious dark streaks that are seen flowing down the slopes of a number of Martian hills, mountains, and craters. But a new study suggests that the evidence supporting the existence of water on the Red Planet was misinterpreted. The study proposes that the dark streaks called recurring slope lineae are now understood as being the result of dry, granular flows of sand and dust from recurring avalanches. U.S. Geological Survey scientist and study lead author Colin Dundas says that the new findings suggest that the surface of Mars is quite dry today. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we look at political uncertainty in Lebanon. Zimbabwe's parliament speaker says Emmerson Mnangagwa will be sworn in as the country's new president on Friday, taking over following the resignation of longtime leader Robert Mugabe. The announcement Wednesday came as Mnangagwa was due to return to Zimbabwe. The former vice president abruptly fled the country November 6 after Mugabe fired him. The 93-year-old Mugabe had ruled Zimbabwe since the country won independence from Britain in 1980. Beverly Peters is professor at American University School of Professional and Extended Studies. She tells me about Mugabe's history of holding on to power despite the controversy surrounding him.
We saw through his 37 years in power that he was able to consolidate his position time and time again, eliminating opposition, conducting suspect elections, engaging in power-sharing mechanisms that weren't real power-sharing mechanisms, alienating opposition leaders and opposition parties and anybody within ZANU-PF that didn't agree with him.
He took over a country that was known as the breadbasket of Africa, and yet he really drove the economy into the ground.
Absolutely. There's a myriad of different reasons that the Zimbabwe economy is where it is now. I think after the liberation struggle in 1980, things were very positive. And if you go back and look at Robert Mugabe's speeches, he spoke quite eloquently about bringing the population together, working together, building a better Zimbabwe, redressing those colonial imbalances, dealing with land reform. And all of that seemed to fade away within the first decade of his rule. Sure, in 1980, 1985, the country was a breadbasket. It was exporting. It was, the economy was vibrant. But over time, corruption and mismanagement seemed to permeate every layer of the economy, including that land reform program that was so crucial to redress those imbalances that took place during colonialism.
What finally led in this latest crisis that finally led to the fact that there was no way that Mugabe could continue to power?
I think you had a situation where the economy was in a free fall. The economy is devastated. People knew that Mugabe was 93 years old. They knew something else was coming. They knew that there would be some sort of change within that presidency. His move to fire Vice President Mnangagwa was the straw that broke the camel's back, as it were. Analysts felt as if he was placing his wife, Grace Mugabe, in a position to take over as the president in the elections that will come in July or August of next year. And that was really the catalyst that started this soft coup, if you will, and the resignation of Mugabe.
Beverly Peters, professor at American University School of Professional and Extended Studies. Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri Wednesday attended Independence Day celebrations in Beirut after returning to the country following announcing his resignation nearly 3 weeks ago from Saudi Arabia in a dispute with Iran-backed Hezbollah. He cited fears of assassination and lashed out at Iran and Hezbollah for sowing discord in Lebanon and across the Arab and Muslim world. His return followed a political intervention by France. Mr. Hariri said he's putting his resignation on hold for now at the request of President Michel Aoun. Mr. Hariri visited France and Egypt before returning to Lebanon, amid concerns Saudi Arabia was keeping him against his will. The resignation appeared to take nearly everyone by surprise and is viewed as part of a larger struggle between Sunni Muslim Saudi Arabia and Shiite-majority Iran. Middle East Institute scholar Zubair Iqbal tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the struggle will determine the viability of Lebanon, a country devastated by a 15-year civil war ending in 1990.
There are three parties, and there are three quote-unquote masters who are pulling the strings. There's Saudi Arabia, there's Iran, and there's France. Now, under the present circumstances, two of them had fallen apart. And the third one would have fallen apart in any case if these two hadn't been able to come together somehow or the other. So, as you can see it, if the movement that has been started by the French government, if it doesn't succeed, then clearly Lebanon will be in crisis, not necessarily turn into a place where people will be fighting against each other. I don't think civil war will take place. But what will happen is this, that the country will simply fall apart and there will be no quote-unquote working institution in place that could keep the place together in a functional way. In a non-functional, dysfunctional way, it will remain together because there's no way, nowhere else that people can go. They're going to be there, period. But they will not be dealing with each other, and the economy will start to tank.
Do we understand why he resigned?
All we have at this moment is what's there in the press and whatever is there in the grapevine. Apparently what has happened is this, that the delicate balance that I was talking about had come sort of unstuck because of the presidency. Now, the question was, the president has been leaning towards the Hezbollah. Hezbollah has clearly won and established its credentials in Syria and elsewhere. Under this, and they're, of course, to be found in small number in Yemen as well. So the point really is, under these circumstances where the conditions were tilting against Hariri and his group, what was to be done? Now, the Saudis, of course, clearly overreacted. I mean, instead of trying to work out the situation in Lebanon itself, they regionalized it. And by regionalizing it, they lost all the initiative or all the credentials that is concerned. Really, they gave up whatever little credentials they had by inviting him, forcing him to resign as is understood, and then backing off from that and letting the French take the ball from there.
That is Middle East Institute scholar Zubair Iqbal. The Hariri resignation threat had upset the power-sharing arrangement that brought him to office last year with Hezbollah, a heavily armed military and political movement. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is International Edition. David Cassidy, the pop culture icon of the 1970s, has died. He was 67. The actor and singer died Tuesday of complications from dementia and multiple organ failure at a Florida hospital. Cassidy was the son of actors Jack Cassidy and Evelyn Ward and born in New York in 1950. Cassidy's stepmother, Shirley Jones, co-starred with him in The Partridge Family, a musical sitcom based on a real family about a widow and her children who embark on a musical career as a band. Cassidy played the oldest son, Keith. Cassidy and the Partridge Family had a number one hit with a catchy tune, I Think I Love You, in the fall of 1970. His biggest solo single was a version of Cherish, which peaked at number 9 after its release in 1971.
Cherish is the word I use to describe.
After ABC canceled The Partridge Family in 1974, Cassidy refocused his energy on live theater and led an original production of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. He continued to add acting credits through the decades, appearing in television shows such as Fantasy Island, Malcolm in the Middle, Ruby and the Rockets, and CSI, as well as the movie Pop Star. Cassidy's publicist, Joanne Geffen, said Cassidy died surrounded by family with joy in his heart and free from the pain that had gripped him for so long. All three of his marriages ended in divorce. He survived by two children, Beau and Katie, stepmother Shirley Jones, and half-brothers Sean, Patrick, and Ryan.
How can I be sure in a world that's constant? Changing, how can I be sure where I stand with you? Whenever I'm away from you, I wanna die.
The music of David Cassidy. Well, that is our show. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States government and the Economic Community for West African States, or ECOWAS, have reaffirmed their commitment and collaboration to strengthen harmonization and delivery of development programs that aid millions of people throughout West Africa. Alex Deprez, Mission Director, U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID West Africa, and the President of ECOWAS, Marcel D'Souza, recognized the multi-year development agreement between the two institutions at an event in Abuja, Nigeria, on November 10th. Under this development agreement, the U.S. government will provide up to $298.7 million over the five-year period of 2015 to 2020 in support of ECOWAS priorities, including strengthening democratic institutions, enhancing economic growth, trade and investment, advancing peace and security, and increasing opportunity and development in sub-Saharan Africa. The development also commits an additional $31.6 million to the development agreement, of which $25.5 million will support countering violent extremism activities in the region. U.S. Deputy Chief of Mission to Nigeria, David Young, reiterated the U.S. government's commitment to supporting African-led solutions by supporting regional organizations to better deliver on their respective mandates. He acknowledged that USAID's Regional Development Cooperation Strategy also supports key U.S. government initiatives, including Trade Africa, Feed the Future, Global Health, Global Climate Change, and the Trans-Sahara Counterterrorism Partnership. The renewed partnership underscores a deep and long-standing cooperation between the United States government through USAID West Africa and ECOWAS. Mr. Young expressed the hope that the signing of this development objective agreement will help both institutions achieve their shared goals to reduce violent extremism, reduce poverty, and improve the health and livelihoods of people across the region.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.